From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, hundreds of thousands of people try to file for unemployment in Michigan and cannot get through.
One quarter of the workforce has filed for unemployment in the state of Michigan. So far, that's over a million people. These are percentages that haven't been seen since the Great Depression.
Also, we follow some of the fault lines in the economy to working poor people who may not meet the criteria for pandemic stimulus checks.
A lot of families already before the pandemic couldn't make their monthly bills or expenses. So they're the folks who need them most. I'm not sure if those are the ones who will get their relief as quickly as they need it, though.
And we check in with a dairy farmer from Kent County in western Michigan. She'll tell us what it's like to be in food production right now and why time with the cows is what's keeping her together. Those stories and more on the way. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Welcome to the show. Today, we're going to check in with Michigan's farm scene, hear a little bit about how food producers are doing amid the pandemic. But first, more than 1 million Michiganders are out of a job right now, and the state is struggling with keeping up with the torrent of unemployment filings. The director of Michigan's Department of Labor and Economic Opportunity says this state has seen one of the biggest surges in the country in applications. With us to discuss the deluge is Zach Gorchow, executive editor and publisher of Gong War, Michigan. Zach, welcome back to Stateside.
Good to be with you.
What do we know about who's out of work right now?
Oh, boy. A historically large number of people, for starters. I mean, one quarter of the workforce has filed for unemployment in the state of Michigan. So far, that's over a million people. These are percentages that haven't been seen since the Great Depression. Who are these folks? We're talking the hospitality industry clearly has taken it on the chin. And then you've got lots of other sectors. You know, anything that involves people who have to show up for in-person work where money's not coming in, layoffs are hitting. It's really, really vast.
I mean, even just to say a quarter of the state, it just boggles the mind.
It's shocking. I mean, when the University of Michigan's research seminar in quantitative economics put out a forecast, and they are kind of the gold standard around the state for economic forecasting, even around the country. And when they projected that unemployment in Michigan for the second quarter of this year, which is what we're in now, would hit 23%, it just, you know,
23%.
Really takes your
breath away. Gosh. Well, what's going on with the state's intake for unemployment assistance?
You know, it is struggling to deal with this massive number of claims in such short compressed time span. It keeps crashing. Now, the Unemployment Insurance Agency says that 95% of those who have applied have successfully gotten their claims filed and processed. Of course, 5% of a million is still a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so you have a lot of people who are deeply frustrated, bordering on, you know, panicking that they've got to get unemployment benefits flowing or they're going to be out of money. So the state is frantically trying to staff up and ramp up the staff that's available, creating time slots when people should call or use the system. You know, they're trying to draw on other partners to help. And while this won't make anybody who's struggling to get through the system feel better, this is happening in a lot of other states too. You know, down in Ohio, Gong War, Ohio, branch down there. I was talking to our folks down there the other day, and they're hitting the same thing in Ohio where the system keeps crashing. It's just, you know, it was not designed to handle a million claims in a few weeks. It just wasn't.
Is there such a thing as a time limit for when one can apply for unemployment benefits? I mean, time is of the essence in terms of people's rent and mortgages and all manner of bills. But would people be able to get retroactive benefits, for example, if they were able to get in a couple of weeks?
No, my understanding is there is a time period. It's a matter of several weeks. It's not like you only have a few days to file from the time you are unemployed, but you can't wait forever. And, you know, this is going to put a big strain on the unemployment fund. Now, it's funded by employers who pay something called the state unemployment tax. And the fund is pretty robust right now. But you put a million people on unemployment, and there are going to be problems. Now, I have no doubt there's going to be considerable federal resources likely directed to help alleviate some of this crush because, you know, in the Great Recession, the state ended up having to take out bonds to make sure it had enough money to cover everything, which were just recently paid off. So as far as whether the state's going to have enough money to pay these benefits, a lot depends on what the federal government does.
Wow. I'm sure it's a huge headache for anyone thinking about state budgets right now. What is Governor Whitmer saying about what's happening with Michigan's economy right now? There's been a sort of growing chorus, mostly from Republican state leaders, like State Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey saying it's time to reopen the economy. In her public statements yesterday, did you hear anything from Governor Whitmer about whether she's optimistic that may happen soon?
I think optimistic would be putting it strongly. I think she said, you know, we're on a trajectory right now. If it continues where you can start to envision it happening in stages, but she really tried to tamp down expectations of that happening soon. What she did do yesterday, I thought for the first time since this started, was really try to delve more into the economic stress and the anxiety people are feeling over lost income and lost jobs. Up until yesterday, largely what the governor had said when asked about the economic crisis was the state had to solve the health crisis first, which is widely agreed upon that the economy will not recover until the coronavirus is knocked back. But the governor hadn't really addressed, you know, and tried to reach out and empathize with what this has done to the economy. And yesterday I thought she did do that. She also discussed publicly for the first time her criteria for when she will start to reopen the economy. You know, last week in her expanded stay-at-home order, she actually did list off 5 criteria to do that, but for whatever reason, she didn't discuss them at all. And I think a lot of these are probably pretty obvious. Things like, what is the rate of the disease's spread? Is the healthcare capacity sufficient? What's the situation on availability of personal protective equipment? What's the state's testing capacity? And what are the economic conditions? Those are the 5 items in the order that she said she's going to use to judge whether to reopen the economy. And I think it's safe to say that based on her criteria that we're not there yet.
It's possibly worth noting that she did mention what is the state of the economy as one of those items.
Yes. Clearly, she's going to have to judge at some point. At what point could you start letting some workers go back to work under really strict social distancing protocols without causing the virus to start festering again? If the governor were to lift aspects of the stay-at-home order and all of a sudden you had a workplace with a lot of people that suddenly becomes a hot spot for infection, that would just be a disaster.
Zach, the Gongwar covers a lot of the business community as well. Do you get any sense that the hunger to reopen Michigan, as the Republicans have put it, is shared within business circles?
I think there's a division there. If you were to talk to the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, which tends to be more conservative, you know, they seem to be very much in line with Speaker Chatfield and Senate Majority Leader Shirkey, that the order is too strict and that the governor should allow some employers to start operating again who currently cannot. But you look at the comments from other organizations like Business Leaders for Michigan, that's the group of statewide CEOs, the Small Business Association of Michigan, that's where you have Brian Kelly, the former lieutenant governor, is the president there and has been speaking out a lot on this issue. They put out very measured statements yesterday. Business Leaders for Michigan said, we support what the governor is doing, period. I think one thing that was interesting from Brian Kelly was he really seemed to point to it was good the governor talked yesterday in a meaningful way about what it's going to take to reopen the economy. There was no pressure in his comments for her to do that, but I think they seem to like the tone and tenor of what was said. So, you know, the other thing I would say on the business front, you know, Governor Snyder did an interview with Mark Halperin that was posted. He hasn't done many interviews, but of course he comes from a business background. And he said flat out, you got to get the health care crisis first. I mean, he sounded a lot like Governor Whitmer. And one thing he said he's been counseling some employers is, just because you reopen the economy doesn't mean consumer demand is there, that you're going to have to restart consumer demand. I mean, what good does it do if Ford, GM, and Chrysler are reopened, but nobody's buying cars?
Not to mention all the supply chain issues in a global economy.
So I don't sense a unanimous opinion by a long stretch in the business community on where things are at.
One last question, Zach. Michigan did not appear among the list of states that are collaborating to start to have that conversation about what conditions would we need to see in order to reopen business as we know it. There are a coalition of eastern states, including New York, and a coalition of western states, including California. But don't you wonder if maybe some of the decisions getting made in the groups of states might have some influence on what Governor Whitmer's thinking?
Well, I think I would be really surprised if we did not see Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin move in tandem in some way as a region, much as you just referenced what's happening on the West and the East Coast. There's practical reasons for doing it because the states border each other. They have a lot in common. And there's good political reasons for doing it, too. I mean, you know, Mike DeWine, the Ohio governor, has gotten a lot of praise for how he's handled things. You've got, of the five states I mentioned, three Democratic governors, two Republican governors. It would lend a sheen of a bipartisan approach and maybe tamp down some of the partisan acrimony that's popped up in the last 72 hours. I would just be very surprised, given how much those governors say they've been talking to each other and that they're dealing with a lot of the same things. You know, and there's going to be some sort of a protest by car in Lansing tomorrow from those who think the governor's orders are too strict. There was one in Ohio yesterday from a lot of conservative types toward Governor DeWine, a Republican. So I think there's both practical and political benefits to them acting in tandem. We shall see.
Zach Gorchow is executive editor and publisher of Gong War, Michigan. Zach, thank you so much. Stay safe.
Thanks for having me. You too.
Americans are starting to see those $1,200 stimulus checks showing up in their bank accounts. But many low-income Americans don't have a bank account. Where does that leave them? That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This week, the federal government is direct depositing economic stimulus checks into bank accounts across the nation. Not everyone is getting them. Terry Friedline is an associate professor of social work at the University of Michigan, and she works on any number of issues pertinent to working people, especially those on the lower end of the economic spectrum. Terry Friedline, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Who do you see these checks assisting most of all?
Well, I think who really needs to get them are people who are experiencing layoffs, don't have enough money to make ends meet. A lot of families already before the pandemic couldn't make their monthly bills or expenses. So they're the folks who need them most. I'm not sure if those are the ones who will get their relief as quickly as they need it, though.
Well, what are your concerns about who's eligible for these payments?
First, you know, there are people who are excluded from the outset for receiving stimulus. Those who are working without documentation in the U.S., maybe those who didn't file taxes, you know, originally, those who didn't file taxes because their incomes were too low, you know, weren't able to receive the initial checks. So that's a concern at the outset in terms of how the policy was designed. As we move forward, I think the people without bank accounts or the people without technology, digital access to be able to receive the checks and actually cash them will be another barrier to getting the money into their hands and to be able to pay their expenses.
You've done research proposing universal bank accounts through financial institutions or maybe setting them up through public institutions like postal banking. If this happened, the government would have an easier time sending out stimulus checks. Why has that not been implemented?
There are a few reasons. One is that policymakers haven't had the political will to require it of banks. So even our neighbor to the north, Canada, nearly two decades ago, required banks to offer low-cost checking accounts. And as a result, nearly everyone in Canada has a basic checking account. So policymakers haven't necessarily had the political will. And secondly, banks are private for-profit institutions. So even though they provide a really important public service, they're still, you know, really interested in kind of maximizing profits and pleasing shareholders.
Terry, what do you feel the new coronavirus has exposed about poverty and the financial system in the United States?
Well, I think it's made it so that we can't ignore the inequalities that exist. So we see 10,000 people in line for a food bank. Many of those families, you know, were in need before the coronavirus. And now the images and the stories and the numbers of folks who are filing for unemployment, the coronavirus has made it that we can't ignore the extent of the disparities or the inequalities or the poverty that existed pre-coronavirus.
Knowing what we know now, what do you think should be different going forward?
You know, certainly proposals where we offer people living wages for the work that they do, for people who are working in grocery stores, making deliveries. When I think of what needs to be different, I want to see systems that support people and kind of value work in a lot of different ways and make sure that people are paid living wages to do that work. I think that we need a better infrastructure in a number of different ways, like the ability to, should there be a national crisis, a global crisis, to be able to send money quickly and efficiently to people when they need it.
Terry Friedline studies social work at the University of Michigan. Terry, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
The stay-at-home order has touched off a complicated series of challenges for Michigan's farmers and food producers. While the routine of growing and processing has remained stable for some people, the chain that gets food to consumers is suffering big disruptions. Ernie Birchmeyer is the Michigan Farm Bureau's Manager of Commodity, Farm, and Industry Relations. He's also a livestock and dairy specialist. Ernie, welcome.
Glad to be with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
What can you tell us about which sectors have been hardest hit right now?
Well, first and foremost is, you know, our farmers are continuing to farm on a daily basis. We need to make sure that, you know, listeners and consumers out there understand that just like they do or just like they would have without COVID-19. We've had some disruptions in the supply chain, but our farmers are still milking cows. They're still raising livestock for meat products. Our fruit and vegetable industry is continuing to move along, although we've had some issues there. And our crop farmers are ready to go to the field and, you know, and put crops in the ground, weather permitting. So our folks continue to move forward. One of the sectors that's been hurt the most as of right now is our nursery, greenhouse, and garden center industry. The governor's executive orders have not allowed for those products to continue to be marketed in the manner in which we've normally marketed them, and that's posed some serious challenges. The recent executive order, eliminated the ability for them to sell plants, you know, at big box stores, the Myers, the Krogers of the world, and the original executive order did not allow for those plants to be marketed at garden centers, all during a time when a majority of our greenhouse industry in the state of Michigan generally generates their income. So that is a real challenge.
You know, one of the things I've been wondering about as this has unfolded is how prevention works in agriculture. Are Michigan's growers and food producers in a position to, in effect, sanitize their own operations?
Well, farmers practice good biosecurity and sanitary measures on a daily basis. They are producing food for our consumers. Certainly with the COVID-19 situation, agriculture has looked more to personal protection equipment, just like every other segment of our industry has. So, you know, in some of those processing plants, that's becoming important material and equipment for those workers. You know, and in many instances on the farms, we're using masks where we need to as well, you know, all to protect each other and try to stop the spread of the coronavirus. So, but first and foremost, our farmers practice good biosecurity measures on the farm every day because that's critical to a quality and safe food supply.
Can you give us the macro picture of how the pandemic is affecting food demand right now? I mean, people have seen meat flying off the shelves at some stores, but it seems there are a lot of other pieces to this puzzle, including service industry, consumers who basically, you know, that's a real bottleneck. But also, I'm kind of wondering what's going on with row crops and overseas exports.
Sure. The food industry, as we know it, has taken a turn here in the last month or so with COVID-19. If we think about the number of meals that are eaten outside of the household, you know, on a normal basis, that's 51% of our meals are consumed outside of the household. And because the restaurants are closed, food institutions are closed, the school system is, you know, basically shut down, sporting events are shut down, none of those meals are being consumed outside of the home now. And consumers have had to go to preparing meals in the home. And because of that, demand at the retail level at the grocery stores has certainly increased. And that is why we saw some empty grocery store shelves. Our retailers are working on a daily basis to try to restock those shelves. But we've had a shift in demand, if you will, from outside of the home to virtually all the food being consumed inside the home. Our processors are keeping up the best that they can. But when you consider the volume of milk or cheese or meat that was consumed in restaurants and food institutions, now all being purchased at the grocery store, that's a big shift that it takes a little bit of time to catch up with, because we package products differently for the grocery store versus the restaurant. International trade has slowed as well. This issue obviously has impacted the entire world. So when you have that and a decrease in demand across the globe, it's going to impact those international trade operations at a time when we had just solidified the China trade deal, you know, phase one of that particular trade deal. We were in the middle of finalizing or had finalized in this country and then implementation of USMCA, the trade agreement between the United States, Mexico, and Canada. And we're looking very positive towards a very solid 2020 from trade relations and trade agreements being put in place. And COVID-19 hit, and it's caused an economic stall, you know, here in the United States and really around the rest of the world.
Well, when you have those kinds of disruptions, what do you think this is going to mean for Michigan agriculture over the long term?
Well, I think we're going to be challenged the rest of the year. We need the system to get back to functioning properly and in a normal manner, whatever that new normal is, and it will have an impact on our farmers from a price standpoint. Whenever you decrease demand, you impact price, and we're seeing that at the farm level now. You know, dairy prices to the farmer are indicated to be down, decreased by 30%. I know we've had some recent discussions about dairy, and those prices have softened. Beef cattle prices, the price paid to our farmers, is down about the same amount. We have a couple of beef processing plants, one here in Michigan on the west side of the state and one in Pennsylvania where we move quite a few cattle to. Both of those plants are shuttered right now and are not processing at full capacity. And when you take that much processing out of a normal daily harvest, it impacts price immediately. We recently heard news over the weekend that one of the largest pork processing plants in the United States has shuttered indefinitely due to COVID-19 outbreaks in that plant.
Right. Smithfield, I believe that's Smithfield Foods in South Dakota, right?
That is correct. Mm-hmm.
Does that have an effect on pork processors here in Michigan?
Well, it will, because there's only so much shackle space in the United States, if you will. And shackle space is a place to hang a hog carcass or a beef carcass on a line and move it through the process and get it processed during that daily time frame. And when you take a system that large out of the equation, it will have an impact. Fortunately, we have a very good packer here in the state of Michigan in Clemens Food Group. It's my understanding that they are still functioning at 100%, and they utilize quite a few of the pigs that are produced here in Michigan for great pork products.
Yeah. This is news that I'm sure no farmer was anxious to hear, but I was mindful of the really incredibly bad weather that Michigan's farmers dealt with last year. I know it's very early, but can you set some context for us about how the growing season was looking before the pandemic really took effect?
Well, we were looking forward with optimism at the growing season for Michigan crop farmers. We had gone through 2019, and that was preceded by a very wet fall in 2018. And we had gone through some real challenges. Last year was one of the most challenging and difficult years on record from a weather standpoint for our farmers. They had problems getting crops in the ground, problems growing that crop, and then it continued to rain, and we had some challenges harvesting a quality crop. Every farmer looks forward in the spring with optimism. There were forecasts of another very wet spring. Fortunately, our farmers have been able to get in the fields to a certain degree so far and get some field work done, and they were looking forward to a more normal year, and they're still looking forward to that, although they're not certain what that price forecast is going to be. So with warmer temperatures, hopefully drier weather, our farmers will go to the fields and get the crops in the ground. Our fruit and vegetable industry is the same way. They have been challenged the last few years with weather issues as well. Fortunately, the spring has been pretty good for our fruit crop in the state of Michigan to set buds. You know, those trees start to bloom and hopefully have a very healthy and productive fruit crop. The fruit and vegetable industry is very concerned right now. They were looking forward to the year with optimism, but with the challenges of not having the ability to sell those bedding plants and those vegetable plants like they do in a normal year, they are very concerned.
Are the state or federal governments helping farmers at this time?
The CARES Act that was passed by Congress and signed by the president does include some money for agriculture. There was about $14.5 billion that was set aside for agriculture, a portion of that directly for the livestock and specialty crops industries, and then the rest at the discretion of the Secretary of Agriculture in terms of how they wanted to use it. Obviously, every segment of our industry is being impacted in one way or another, and we're just hoping that those dollars can be made available soon to help stem the tide, if you will, of these low commodity prices and the economic impact to farmers. Farmers would much rather get their income from the marketplace, and they've always been that way and will always be that way, but we're dealing with a disaster here that no one could have predicted.
Ernie, some farmers are in a really unfortunate position of just not being able to get their products in front of the consumer and have had to just call it a loss, either plowing vegetables under, or we've heard reports out of state of milk being dumped. Can you give us some context about why some of those foods aren't making it elsewhere, maybe in the form of a donation or sold to institutions that are running right now that might need them?
Well, part of that has to do with the supply chain and how we can get that food processed and where it's shipped to. Obviously, we've had sickness issues across the country, and when you have a large percentage of the folks that work in some of those industries that are impacted, or a small percentage, it takes workers out of the processing line, and we have less ability to get that food processed. You know, you get into regions of the country, California, Florida right now, they are producing a lot of fresh vegetables. And there are instances of where those foods have had to be destroyed because they could not get into even the food banks or donation programs. Milk dumping issues are happening in other areas. We've been fortunate in Michigan that has not been the case right now. But it is truly a matter of getting it processed in the right manner and in the right packaging to get it into those systems to be able to be utilized.
What are the considerations that farmers have to think about if they're trying to decide whether to make the investments to, you know, take those vegetables or that milk and try to sell it in a different way?
Sure. Well, the consideration has to be who are they marketing to? How are they processing it? Do they have the distribution available to get it into the proper channels? But a lot of these decisions about how much is being produced and where it's produced and the type of crops that I'm going to grow, those are not just overnight decisions. Those are decisions that have been made months and sometimes years in advance. A lot of those crops, especially the fruit and vegetable crops, they went in the ground months ago with plans of a normal distribution system to get that product to where it normally goes in the food chain with normal processors and normal retail outlets, and we've had a disruption in all of that. So those decisions were made a long time ago. Question is, can they find a processor that is willing to put it in the type of of a package or in the type of a product that whether the food bank needs it, or can be distributed through some other channel is available.
Ernie, thanks for the update on all this. We hope you and yours are safe and reasonably healthy right now.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Along with my job, I also farm on a daily basis. So I have livestock that need to be taken care of, you know, all in an attempt to make sure that we're continuing to supply a safe, affordable, abundant food supply to consumers, not only here in Michigan, but across the United States. And when those international trade opportunities happen, we want to be involved in that marketplace as well. So it's a daily grind. It's one where we are all having to adjust and learn and do things differently. But our farmers love to produce the food and fiber for our country, and they're proud to do it, and they do it on a daily basis.
Ernie Birchmeyer with the Michigan Farm Bureau. Ernie, take care.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on the show, we'll talk to a dairy farmer about how disruption in the food supply chain is affecting the industry as folks stay home, cook more, and eat out less.
That's changed overnight how people consume 70% of their dairy.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan's food producers are in a bind right now. So many customers, so few ways to reach them. Many of the products that we buy in grocery stores are still available, toilet paper notwithstanding, but COVID-19 has sparked some subtle disruptions for the food industry that go way beyond the point of sale. Annie Link is a partner in Swiss Lane Farms in Kent County, not far from Alto. Swiss Lane produces dairy products. Annie, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Why don't you tell us about your operation?
Yeah, so Swiss Lane Farms was started in 1915 by my great-grandpa. He came over from Switzerland. He wanted to live the American dream and become a farmer, so he started working at the Wingeyer Farm, and he ended up marrying the farmer's daughter. So they bought the farm right around the corner, right next door, and that's where Swiss Lane Farms was started. So I am fourth generation at Swiss Lane, but technically I'm a fifth generation dairy farmer in Alto because of the Wingeyers. So just as our family grew, our farm grew right along with it. My great-grandpa started out with just a handful of cows and a couple of big red barns, and our farm looks a whole lot different today. But those values that he brought here from Switzerland are what, and I think the reason why this farm is still standing today. So our farm looks a whole lot different. How we do things has changed, but really why we do things hasn't changed at all. We've got 2,000 milking cows.
Oh, wow.
We're farming around 5,000 acres.
I understand that there are several dozen employees, that this has gone beyond just a family concern, right?
Right. That's the cool part. It's not just our family anymore. We have a team of amazing people that have come alongside of us and are trying to help us. Our farm's 105 years old. Well, we're trying to get to 200 years old. We've got 95 years left. So we need people to surround us and help us to carry on that legacy. So we've got about 50 employees right now.
How is everyone?
This has been tough. But the great thing about being on a farm, we're essential, you know, and we have essential work that needs to get done. We have work that can't stop. So the one thing that's good about all this is that we do get some sort of normalcy in our day. I am very thankful for being able to work and being able to take care of the cows every day and focusing on them instead of all the chaos that's going on all around us. The schedule at the farm is stayed pretty much the same.
I take it COVID or the stay-at-home order have not had an effect on your workforce or production? Has everyone been able to stay healthy?
Well, in a broad sense, no. Our employees are very healthy. We had one guy who had a cold and he stayed home from work for a week. He didn't have a fever or anything like that. So other than that, it's been just kind of business as usual. Cows are very habitual. They thrive when you give them a very consistent environment. And so a routine and systems are very important to cows. Like we have our milking schedule, our feeding schedule, everything is scheduled down to the minute almost. So if we're even behind like 30 minutes on our milking schedules, you know, something breaks,
the cows let us know. They're Bellerin or whatever. They just thrive on that consistency.
Wow. So the cows are sort of aware of all these fluctuations. Would you say that they have any awareness of what's going on right now as the rest of the country is kind of freaking out?
No, they have no idea. That's what I think is just the coolest thing about the cows is they just go about their day. They're eating their delicious meal that we get verified for them through our nutritionist who has a PhD. He's designing their rations. We come and dump it out for them, and then they're chewing on that for about, you know, 5 or 6 hours a day. Then they go lay down in their little sand beds, and we have fans that turn on. Last week, even the fans came on. I'm blowing nice, cool air on them all day. They go and get milked for a few minutes, about 5 minutes, and then come back to the barn, and they just do their thing. And that's the cool thing about cows. Just they are these creatures that are designed to eat things that we can't eat, like corn and corn cobs and hay. And then they can turn that into something that we can eat. We call it the little miracle of milk. Like there's this little miracle going on inside their bodies every single day, you know, making this these delicious dairy products for us. I mean, they eat hay and then we get to eat ice cream. It's awesome.
Would you say that there's something kind of helpful about being around cows at a time like this, which, you know, for a lot of people is kind of stressful as we worry about health and safety and worry about how friends and relatives are doing?
Yeah, I think anytime that you can be out in nature and kind of experiencing some of these things, it just is able to be a stress reliever. So yeah, there's even at MSU, they were promoting, I think it was last spring break, they were offering to their students $40 to come and like hug a cow or something like that. There's these cow cuddling sessions. And it is a thing. Like I tell you, just being around animals and being out in nature and just seeing the beauty in some of these small and simple things is just something to really hold on to during times like this.
The economics of the dairy industry were very tough before anyone had ever heard of the new coronavirus. Can you tell us what's going on with milk prices right now?
Yeah. So the beginning of the year, we were so excited. Our milk prices were coming up. We were getting about $18 for every 100 pounds of milk we sell. We don't deal with milk in the gallons at the farm level. We deal with it for every 100 pounds. For every 100 weight, we call it, we were getting $18 for our milk for January and February. And then when this whole pandemic came in, we're seeing milk prices at $11 or $12. That's a 38% reduction in what we're getting for every 100 pounds of milk we sell.
Wow. How much of your business relies on restaurants and food service?
Yeah. So the industry as a whole, about 70% of all milk was consumed through food service, restaurant, and schools and exports. So if you combine all those markets, every single one of those is being totally disrupted right now by this pandemic. Our industry is seeing right now that there's about a 10 to 15% oversupply because we haven't been able to shift the way that the milk is being processed and where the milk is being processed. To go from food service to retail looks very different.
Can you take us through the chain of events that happened to get your milk into consumers' hands?
Basically, what a dairy farm has to do is just get the milk out of the cow and cool it down. I've simplified it into those two things. So we just got to get out of the cow, cool it down. And then we have an agreement, a contract with our co-op. So they're like a broker for our farm. We go through DFA, Dairy Farmers of America. And what they do is they have relationships with different customers. They'll have a contract with Kobani or Dannon or Kraft, or right now our milk is going to Country Fresh, which is about 20 miles from here in Grand Rapids. They're processing a lot of fluid milk, and then they make other things like ice cream and cottage cheese, things like that. And then they'll sell it under different brands like Country Fresh, Dairy Pure, our family brand, which is a local Spartan Nash retailer in the Grand Rapids area.
What's happening with the company that does this processing of, you know, turning the milk into other products that people need right now?
So what's happening is the milk that is going to the grocery store, there's kind of a backup in the supply chain. So the people used to be getting their milk off of like the Starbucks. They'd go through the drive-thru at Starbucks and that's how they would get their milk. But now they want their milk just in a gallon jug off the store shelf. So all of a sudden, that's changed overnight. How people consume 70% of their dairy has changed. And we're not able to all of a sudden you've got the processor and then you've got the retailer not able and not ready for that big of a change overnight. So we've got to kind of catch up. And then the way that they bottle their milk. So like if our milk had been going to a big bulk cheese plant, which it does, sometimes it'll go to, it's called Maselli's Cheese in Ohio. And they make a bunch of like Italian cheeses, which is a lot of mozzarella that goes on pizza and stuff like that. So that would come out into a huge, like giant block of mozzarella cheese. And then it would go on to like Domino's or Pizza Hut or somewhere like that. Well, now you're not getting your milk or your dairy product from Domino's or from Pizza Hut. You now want it in a gallon jug or in a little 1 pound pouch that's all shredded. That, like, they can't just all of a sudden stop producing that big block of cheese and then all of a sudden start producing hundreds of thousands of pounds of milk into the little shredded baggies. So it just, it's going to take some time. And processors right now, are they willing to invest in changing all their equipment and stuff over? It's a pretty big deal.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Michigan dairy industry with Annie Link of Swiss Lane Farms. It's near Alto on the west side of the state. I imagine it's hard for people to know if it's worth that investment to try to retool to just sell milk in a completely different way, not knowing if this situation is going to keep going for a month or 6 months or where are we going to be 18 months from now.
Yeah. And then if you think about all the other infrastructure that we use to make any of those investments, like any of the dyes or the like a machine repair, like a lot of that stuff, they can't even work. Even if we wanted to, it might not even be an option.
There were some really heartbreaking stories reported over the weekend. Farmers in other states around the Great Lakes experiencing similar problems to what you're talking about. You know, they're producing just fine, but all these supply chain disruptions are happening. And, you know, people don't have anything to do with their product. Have you been in a situation at Swiss Lane where you've had to dump product yet?
No, we haven't. Our co-op did call and they said they were trying to plan ahead for maybe not being able to get our milk into the processing facilities over the Easter weekend, but that didn't happen. So we have not dumped any of our milk. And I haven't heard of any local farmers that have had to do that either. It has been in other states where they're producing more for the food service industries, where Michigan is not quite so geared towards that. Yeah.
Annie, have you heard any conversations or have there been any conversations at Swiss Lane about whether this crisis of the moment, you know, suggests anything about the way dairy works in Michigan, or maybe should things be any different going forward?
Well, our industry as a whole has laid out a plan and a proposal, and we're waiting just to see where that sits with like our federal aid. So some of the plan was to try to reduce the production by about 10%. And then trying to subsidize the farmers during this time so we could try to control the supply a little bit. We think during this time where we're not very big supporters of trying to control the market, I think the consumers and our customers should control the market and let the market decide what it needs. But during this time where no one has control over anything, like we do think that there needs to be something to fill this gap until we can get back up or till we can at least decide what the new normal is going to be. We can't just shut down our operations on the farm. So what are we going to do in the meantime to make sure, like, while all these changes are made or if these changes need to be made, that the cows are still here and the farms are still here?
What's it like to consider a future in which, you know, production is just going to look different and maybe smaller?
Yeah, it's hard for me to think that this isn't just a short or temporary thing. I think because on a global scale, I just think the need for people to get high quality protein and high quality food is just going to keep increasing. And the way that we can innovate with dairy and what we can do with that and how that nutrition is good for our bodies, I think that is going to be something that's going to just keep increasing over the future. While this might be kind of a small, you know, snapshot, I just think there is a huge need globally for people to get really good nutrition, and dairy is a great way to do that. And it tastes good too. So that's the really good thing about dairy. So I think the American dairy industry has great future going forward if we can work out some of these export markets and things like that. And even the demand in the U.S. is increasing. Like we might not be drinking fluid milk like we used to 50 years ago, but how we consume like Greek yogurt. I mean, I love my smoothies with my Greek yogurt. I just think that is going to be increasing too. And I don't know if you knew this, but it actually takes about 10 pounds of milk to make 1 pound of cheese. And cheese is great for the keto diet. I mean, awesome. So I think just how we're consuming dairy changes, and then that changes the demand for dairy too. So I don't see this as being like, we're not going to need milk in the future. I think we're going to need to keep producing more milk, but just how it's consumed, you know, instead of fluid milk versus cheese or butter or something like that, or where we're sending your milk to will change.
You know, farmers deal with so many different kinds of uncertainty, from weather and how that might, how that might affect crops that feed the cows, to the health of the herd. How would you rate what's happening right now compared with what your family has seen and dealt with over the generations?
Yeah. So weather is, you're getting me right after the Easter holiday, where I've just been reflecting so much on my faith. And being a dairy farmer, you realize just how little you are in control over the weather, right? You can't control. Last year would not stop raining. We couldn't get our crop in the ground. And then we could barely get the crop off the field because it was just so wet. And so just realizing like, okay, you know, God is showing us these trials and, you know, making us change and innovate on how we're planting or how we're harvesting. This is so different because I feel like it's not just weather, it's on all aspects. It's coming at us from the social, from the spiritual, from the government, from everything is being impacted, not just our crops, but even our whole community. So it's different. That's for sure.
Well, Annie, it's such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for taking a minute away from your usual work to speak with us.
Yeah, thanks. It was great. Thanks for telling our story.
Annie Link is a partner with Swiss Lane Farms in Kent County. We're pretty sure that the economic picture won't be pretty for all Michigan's farmers. Dustin Walsh with Crane's Detroit Business has been following the economic problems of dairy farmers over many months, and also the grocery store supply chain issues. He recently tweeted that many dairy farmers won't make it successfully out of this quarantine. And he joins us now for a little context. Dustin, what gives you the sense that some dairy farms aren't going to make it?
Well, so if we look back at what has been going on in the dairy industry for quite some time, they've had about 5 years of basically continual losses, meaning that they were not breaking even on the inputs they were putting in. From feed to their animals, from taking care of the animals all the way to market. They went for about 5 years without making any money. Things started to look pretty good this year, late last year and into this year, basically until the coronavirus hit the United States and started impacting. So what we're seeing is prices are just eroding. And we have major supply chain issues, as we've discussed. There are people dumping milk. And so really the financial pressures are there. And long-term, it only gets worse because we are obviously entering into a global recession.
Who's more vulnerable right now, the small family farm or large commercial operations?
And I think that's the question that's going to be needed to be answered. But I think if we look at what's going on right now when it comes to when we come out of this and what that looks like, it's always going to be the small business. The smaller you are, the less you're going to be able to basically protect yourselves and protect your families and your workers. So that's always going to be the issue. And we have to forget that credit terms and liquidity are already maxed out. And then it's really going to come down to how much government assistance they can get and how long that's going to float them.
Well, does government assistance, has that taken shape already? Are there business loans or different kinds of unemployment benefits that might carry some operations?
Right. So the USDA is working out what they're going to be. There's a lot of talk about direct buying. So basically that's not just in dairy, that's in all forms of agriculture, where the government will step in and actually buy the products, and that'll actually help raise prices. And then the government can then distribute the milk, the food elsewhere into maybe food pantries, etc.
Dustin Walsh of Crane's Detroit Business. Dustin, thank you.
Thank you.